Hi, everyone. Oh, that was louder than I thought. Welcome to LSE for this event today. My name is Shika Dulari. I am a fellow in International Relations Theory in the Department of International Relations here at LSE. I'm really delighted to be chair for our event today, and it's really nice to see so many familiar faces, students, colleagues, friends. So today's event is titled Seeing Beyond the Core, Alternative Visions of Order in Times of Global Crisis. And since that's a pretty big title, I thought I'd give a little bit of context. So as various crises engulf the world system, from climate catastrophe to tariff wars to the genocide in Gaza, I could go on. This event is yet another and very humble attempt to make sense of what is often referred to as a collapsing liberal international order. But instead of trying to diagnose this collapse from the vantage point of the imperial core, or the kind of global north broadly construed, as is commonly done and as is important to do, our task today is to consider how the current order looks when viewed from an internally differentiated global south. And this raises questions for us over what kind of crisis we're living through, and if we are in a crisis, and if a new world order is emerging, as many suggest that it is. It raises the question of who gets to define it and under what conditions. So, admittedly, this is a pretty tall order for an hour and a half on a Wednesday evening. But thankfully, we have a really stellar group of panelists to help us make sense of the various morbid symptoms that shape the present as the old is arguably dying and the new struggles to be born, to riff off Gramsci. So, in order of speaking, we have, on my right, Dr. Jenna Marshall, who's a lecturer in international studies at King's College, just down the road. Then we have Dr. Ilya Salami, assistant professor in the political economy of development at Cambridge. Then we have Dr. Jasmine Ghani, assistant professor in international relations theory, also here at the LSE. And then finally on the screen, we have Dr. Lina Ben-Abdullah, McCulloch Family Faculty Fellow and Associate Professor at Wake Forest University, who will be joining us online behind me here.
Hi everyone, I think the platform is on mute, so I'm not sure, I don't know what's happening. I'm just assuming here, all that you have to say.
Yes.
Thank you guys on mute.
Thanks, Lina. And then we also have discussant. We also have discussant for today, the very wonderful Julia Shirati, who's also a fellow in international relations here at the LSE. So the very rough kind of running order for today is that Julia is first going to introduce the questions that we asked our panelists, and then we'll invite the respective panelists to share their interventions. I'll then turn back to Julia for some discussant comments, and after that we'll open the floor to Q&A. We'll have about 30 minutes for Q&A, so there'll be kind of ample time to speak to the wonderful panelists. Before we get into things, a couple final housekeeping points. So please note that everything except the Q&A will be recorded. And assuming there aren't any technical difficulties, there should be a podcast that will be made available in due course. And then finally, please do put your phones on silent so that your phone rings aren't immortalized in said podcast if it does come out. Okay, I think without further ado, I'll pass over to Julia.
So thank you so much, Shika, for this introduction. And I just want to echo what you just said. I'm really grateful for all of you to be here today. And picking up on what you just shared, our questions to the panelists today are informed by the fact that much of the current debate about the crisis of the so-called liberal international order come from the same frameworks that actually built it. But this leaves out so many perspectives that are actually essential to understanding how the global order is lived today and also reshaped in practice. So our aim today, I want to disclose, is not to settle on what the state of order is or decide among ourselves what it will or should be. Our panelists, from our knowledge at least, don't have a crystal ball, but maybe they do, so we'll see. But rather, it's an attempt to reevaluate the same categories that we usually rely on. In that spirit, the questions that we pose to our panelists are, So first, a broad question about how do the development ideas and practices that actually emerge from the context that all of our different panelists work on actually do complicate or challenge dominant understandings of the today's crisis that we're witnessing? And secondly, how might these developments, ideas, and practices actually form this context and open new ways of thinking about the future of the world order? So very, very easy questions for Wednesday evening.
Okay, thanks so much, Julia. We'll now pass over to Jenna.
Okay, so thank you all for inviting me here tonight, and thank you all to the audience as well. So I'll begin by saying that I think that the dominant perspectives on global order is legible only through a Western, but equally partial framework. As it stands then, a narrative of crises situates global institutions and US hegemony as key markers that uphold order. However, I argue that these frameworks are incapable of explaining crises that are world-spanning and systemic. Moreover, it says little to the critical interlocutors from the global south who interpret crises not necessarily as a breakdown of order, but as globally entangled violence. So with this in mind, I want us to consider crises not from the perspective of interstate relations and its global institutional architecture. That is not to say that we exclude it, but rather to consider the perspective of intercultural relations. And here I draw on the work of Naeem Inayatullah and David Blaney and their idea of knowing encounters. So they craft an understanding of global ordering as one premised on colonial encounters and how these encounters have over time cultivated collective knowledge of the world. And from this work, I take that order and crises require that we take seriously the matter of culture because it allows us to discern how order is perceived and interpreted in different local contexts. In short, it opens up our view of multiple orders existing at any given time. And this point of view is significant to the question of future orders, which I will respond to in a few minutes. Suffice it to say, if we take a knowing encounters approach, one that is gleaned from a local context, my work is particularly grounded and made theoretically legible through the context of the plantation. I argue that the plantation holds within it a series of logics and arrangements, that is, a mode of ordering, that gives way to multiple and enduring crises, those premised on colonialism, slavery, migration, and extraction. From this position, we can observe how structures, global in nature, come to dominate from the plantation. Examples of these are mass surveillance, incarcerality, racial subjugation, environmental degradation, and indigenous dispossession. So again, this is a mode of ordering that forms part of polycentric orders that functions in many parts of the world and is typically obscured when there is this singular understanding of Western liberal order. So to complete my response to the first prompt, dominant crisis narratives treat global challenges as disruptions or aberrations to what is deemed as an essentially sound and coherent system. However, a plantation order framework reveals that the system itself, a global capitalist modernity, was founded on and continues to operate through institutions of dispossession, unfreedoms, and appropriation. The indexing of crises, whether it be the migrant crises or climate, are actually an ongoing operation of global orders experienced from the very beginning of global capitalism that was executed in part via the plantation. But also what is necessary to acknowledge is that the plantation order is not only about the imposition of these modes of structural violence, but is also to position how subjugated populations have endured and negotiated under these conditions. So, to the second question, rather than speculate on the future of world order, I am more inclined to interrogate how much of the enduring logics of the plantation fundamentally shape and reshape the current moral and normative order. And I explore this through the case of reparations. So, just a little background. Plantations formed, and this is from the 17th century onward, a wider ecosystem of financial institutions, including joint stock companies, most famous the East India Company, but also the Royal African Company, the Close Harbor Company, and so on. As well as other colonial formations, be it settler colonies and colonial military outposts. So this demonstrates that such a global order operated through networked institutional forms that not only exceed the state, but in some cases, and some cases also predate the formation of the nation state, in the case of the East India Company as well as the Dutch East India Company. So the growing calls for reparations initiated by Pan-Africanist movements have proposed entirely different institutional forms and relationships. In a sense, alternative set of knowing encounters. Former Western colonial empires are thus forced to reckon with demands for compensation in the form of financial transactions, but it also gestures towards a recognition of this global and historical organized extraction of impoverished and racialized populations. So seen from the plantation, reparations constitutes a fundamental challenge to a particular architecture of a new moral order, one that is cognizant of the historical wrongs of enslavement and land dispossession, but also to express a moral claim that is both anti-racist and anti-capitalist. So dominant approaches, and again here I read it as liberal, treat order as being about stability and sovereignty. However, in the case of reparations, it brings into a focus demands that reorient order around historical justice and redistribution. So I'll end there.
Thanks so much, Jenna. I'll now pass on to Elias.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Thanks so much for the invitation. Pleasure to be here. It's actually the first time I speak at the LSE, so, you know, big first for me. I hope my remarks will be as clear as Jenna's. I think there'll be also some productive tension, perhaps. So, okay, my remarks will focus on a specific aspect of world order, which is global development. As many of you will know, the field of global development is undergoing turbulent transformations. A few examples will suffice to illustrate this point. Earlier this year in February, the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, accused South Africa of anti-Americanism and refused to attend a G20 meeting in Johannesburg later this month. In March, the Trump administration stated that, quote, it rejects and denounces the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. In early July, the US Agency for International Development, USAID, has officially closed its doors after Trump gradually dismantled the agency over its allegedly wasteful spending. So these examples and other attempts on the part of the US to directly sabotage or undermine multilateral development initiatives have generated indignation, outrage, if not panic, amongst liberal commentators, primarily oriented towards the MAGA project, that is, Make America Great Again. But as economic historian Adam Tooze reminds us, indignation at MAGA should not make us blind to a broader set of failures associated with the liberal global development project. So these include multiple and interacting political, ideological, geopolitical, economic, and environmental crises, or what Adam Tooze calls the polycrisis. So how did we get here? Well, to answer this question, I think it's helpful to draw on the work of geographer Gillian Hart, and in particular on what she calls the dialectic of small d development and big D development. Big D development is development as you probably know it. This refers to the conscious efforts, projects, discourses, and practices of intentional intervention in the so-called post-colonial world. And small d development refers to the uneven and combined development of capitalism as a global economic system and as a mode of social domination. So for Gillian Hart, the evolution of this small d, big D development dialectic is a major driver of social change, and therefore it can help us understand the present conjuncture. So what has happened to this dialectic over the past couple of decades? Well, looking at small d development first, we have seen multiple crises which states increasingly struggle to govern following liberal principles. Secondly, we've seen deep tendencies towards economic stagnation and industrial overcapacity and growing difficulties of capitalism to absorb people as wage laborers, which poses problems for both richer and poorer countries. Thirdly, we've seen intensified competition over trade, investment, and technological supremacy. Fourth, we've seen a reshuffling of geoeconomic force fields, which has led to, in turn, more multipolarity in the global economy, notably the assertion of new business classes and segments of capital from the non-West, and the unraveling of the US-led world order, which is further accelerating these transformations. Fifth, these transformations have compelled governments in the global North and in the global South to re-embrace the tools of state ownership and of muscular state intervention. So overall, what we're seeing is a form of capitalism with a distinctively new flavor, one where the connective tissue that meshes the world economy is increasingly infused with aggressive state power, one where an increasing amount of capital and assets is concentrated in the hands of states, and where this very process of state-led accumulation is fueling inter-imperialist antagonism between countries. At the same time, now moving on to big D development, this also has experienced significant crises. We've seen a failure of development understood as structural adjustment plus aid plus NGOs. This is because this version of development has delivered very little for the global South, including on its own terms. Similarly, the attempt to mobilize private finance to fund development goals, or what economist Daniela Gabor has called the Wall Street consensus, this is also failing miserably. In the words of US Secretary of State, former US Secretary of State Larry Summers, billions to trillions, which is the catchphrase for the World Bank's plan to mobilize private sector money for development, has become, quote, millions in, billions out. So in addition to that, we've seen the global vaccine apartheid in the aftermath of COVID-19. We've seen the genocidal destruction of Gaza, the abysmal treatment in the global north of racialized migrants and refugees, the repeated failures on the part of richer countries to deliver on climate finance commitments and to resolve enduring debt crisis in the global south, the rise of far-right politics and revanchist nationalism in the rich world, and the deep collapse of liberal, democratic, social compacts and class compromises pretty much everywhere they existed. So all of those things have contributed to a global crisis of liberalism, a crisis of the moral superiority of the West, and the decay of the so-called rules-based international order. So in short, what we have is a conjuncture characterized by a multidimensional crisis of both big D and small d development, which leads me to the second prompt. What kind of visions are emerging in the ruins of development? I can see at least five visions of development emerging on the part of, or putting forward by states. The first one is that of China, as a new model of tech-powered electro-state modernity, embodying the promise of development and material transformation and a green techno-industrial future. This is a vision which I think exerts a powerful grasp on imaginaries in the global south, particularly because it demonstrates remarkable feats in terms of both state planning and capitalist competition and innovation. This is a vision and project which is becoming a lot more self-confident and assertive on the global stage, and which now presents itself as the defender of multilateralism and international collaboration. Now, needless to say, this is a vision and project which is not without contradictions, including producing tremendous amount of waste and destruction in the social, human, and environmental sense. The second vision is one of imperial state capitalism with a techno-imperial twist, such as the one that is emerging at the very heart of the US empire. It features new blends of platform capitalism with authoritarianism, empowered defense and national security working alongside Silicon Valley tech overlords, a reassertion of imperial power in the world while enforcing techno-fascism at home, and a curious mix of techno-optimism on the one hand and an extravagant fear of Western civilizational collapse on the other. The third vision is the one prevailing in Europe, that is, a non-vision. The best the EU seems to be able to do at this point is to act, and this is in the words of an EU commissioner, as a, quote, lifestyle superpower. This non-vision is the product of a clear lack of imagination on the part of European ruling elites and their refusal altogether to compromise in the slightest with subordinated classes. So what we have then is a project which may remain caught between, on the one hand, dangerous militarism and increased military spending, and on the other hand, austerity for the masses, which will only fuel class conflicts. So needless to say, no one is inspired by this, in the slightest, by this vision. The fourth vision is one of non-Western sub-imperialist and regional hegemons, such as Turkey, the UAE, India, and others, which combine reactionary ideologies with selective indignation at the Western-dominated world order, while cooperating with imperial powers to extend geopolitical, economic, and cultural influence. The fifth vision is one that is more progressive and that we find in many countries or in many corners of the global south, from Indonesia to Brazil, South Africa, and Chile. It draws on past histories and symbols of non-alignment and third worldism to make the case for economic, ecological, and digital sovereignty, for a fairer and more diverse international system, for more global coordination in terms of climate finance, and for green industrial policy deployment. So there's much to appreciate, of course, in this progressive project, and yet it often remains committed to conventional visions of development. That is, development largely conceived as market integration into globalized supply chains, only this time in a way that is more open to the non-West, with more climate finance, more policy autonomy, more solar panels, and now a bunch or a lot more data centers. So let me wrap up with three more visions, this time coming from below or from non-state actors, which I find particularly inspiring. The first one is articulated by the so-called Gen Z protests. Indeed, just this year, we've seen a proliferation of youth-led protests from Nepal to Morocco, Madagascar, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and other places, expressing the familiar cry for justice and broad-based development against corruption and elite wealth accumulation, and for public services, the commons, and a dignified life. Secondly, another set of struggles, those of pro-Palestine activists and dock workers blocking ports in Greece, Italy, France, Australia, and elsewhere to prevent military cargo from reaching Israel. This calls our attention to the need to center international solidarity against war, militarism, and imperial violence in visions of development. And finally, and I'll conclude here, I find inspiration in the work of think tanks and initiatives like Commonwealth in the UK, which tell us that reclaiming power and control over our collective future will require reimagining forms of planning and ownership of our productive activities beyond capital and the state. Thank you very much.
Great, thanks so much, Ilias. I'm also waiting for Gen Z to save us. And then I will now pass over to Jasmine.
Can everyone hear me? Great. Thanks, Julia. Thanks, Shika. Thanks to my excellent fellow panelist friends for their comments. So let me start by addressing the crisis that the title refers to. What is the crisis? It's a polycrisis. So I will focus on the crisis of international law, often seen as the bedrock of the liberal international order. Over the past decade, key institutions upholding the liberal international order have been crippled or compromised. The system has been damaged by US withdrawal from various international organizations and agreements, the Paris Climate Accords, the World Health Organization, UN Human Rights Council, and other states like the UK are contemplating similar moves. US sanctions on the International Criminal Court, the ICC, have jeopardized the court's credibility and created major financial obstacles to war crimes investigations in Ukraine and Gaza. The UN Security Council has been deadlocked for nearly 15 years, first over Syria, lately over Gaza, thanks to the veto by permanent members, and of course, we've witnessed the failure of international law to halt a genocide in Gaza. Una Hathaway, Professor of Law at Yale University, spoke about some of Trump's actions, which have contributed to so many of these acts that have undermined international law, as an attempt to, I quote, reshape the global legal order, transforming it from one governed by law to one governed by might. While another group of lawyers described international law as, I quote, a dead man walking. Now, to see all this as a crisis, referring to earlier comments, i.e. the idea we are at a turning point, a critical juncture in which the existing international order is at risk, is in many ways to take a liberal perspective, because it assumes international order was working before, and secondly, it assumes that these violations are a new phenomenon. But if we draw from the debates of the fields I work in, and my colleagues are working in post-colonial, decolonial, critical legal studies, the use of the term crisis would be inaccurate. Rather than seeing international order, and by extension international law, as entering a new phase, critical scholars have long argued the violations are a feature of the system rather than a glitch. Anthony Angi famously argued all the way back in 2006, I quote, colonialism, far from being peripheral to the discipline of international law, is central to its formation. What evidence then can be given for these claims? Briefly, and firstly, history exposes the exclusionary nature of international law conceived by its architects as applicable only to those deemed capable of reason, while those deemed to be deficient of reason, i.e. not fully human, often on the basis of race or gender, were excluded from the protections and responsibilities of international law. Secondly, even when international law was intended to be universal, it was colonialism that allowed international law to be universalized and expanded beyond Europe, and not to facilitate justice, but to be used as a civilizing mission. And thirdly, as Barr, Bluen, and Owisi have argued, post-war iterations of international legal institutions, especially the ICC, helped prioritize war crimes that were carried out against Europeans in Europe, e.g. the Nuremberg trials, or war crimes by non-Europeans against other non-Europeans, but at the expense and erasure of atrocities carried out by Europeans against non-Europeans under colonialism. So what does this mean? Is this then business as usual, that there is no real crisis in the liberal international order? It's working as it always was meant to be. And is there anything that those critical of the liberal order need to mobilize around? So here I would disagree with some of the arguments that there is no real crisis here. I think there is a crisis. But the crisis relates to the facade of the universal application of international law. The crisis relates to the facade that hegemonic powers were equally restrained by it, but it's what is clearly falling away. Now, on one hand, that might seem like something to be welcomed. It would mean exposing the duplicity of the liberal order. The problem is, those who desire justice and equality are not the only critics of the liberal order. Right now, we are contending with a full-blown rise of fascism on a global level, at the government level, and the grassroots level. And they too are seeking to dismantle the liberal international order. And one of their primary targets is international law. So I think the challenge here is, how can the existing system be rightly and necessarily critiqued without aiding the momentum of fascists? When it comes to international law in particular, I think there needs to be some intellectual and ethical caution amongst critical fields, my own including, and to look to developments in the Global South. Historically, Global South societies have turned to international law as a means of protection against their own oppressive governments, whether effective or not. The Global South historically played an important role in petitioning and writing international law, and not only states, which have their record of oppression, but as Rajagopal has shown, social movements too. When Thembeka Nukaitobi, one of the lawyers of the stellar South African team who challenged Israel at the ICJ, came to speak at the LSE last year, he also spoke about the importance of the law as a form of truth-telling. So looking forward then, how can we see a role for international law in a world in crisis? And far be it from me to untangle this and give the answers, and I'm not speaking as an international lawyer, but I'd say the struggle over international law is not only in the legal realm, but, and perhaps especially so, in the political realm. Let's take, again, for example, the ICJ, the International Court of Justice. The significance of the ICJ ruling back in January 2024 regarding a plausible genocide in Gaza was not only in its legally binding power to directly influence Israel, which it failed to do, evidently, but its significance lay in the fact it was a catalyst of mobilization and transnational solidarity outside the realms of the law. So I'd end on this note. This requires, especially on the intellectual front, to be wary of epistemological cynicism, and instead to listen to social movements, including those who are fighting legal battles, having been involved in direct action, as well as supporting those still battling for justice in the legal field. We've only just recently heard of the outcome of the lawyers representing Palestine Action winning in their case against the Home Office to ensure that there'd actually be a review of the Home Office prescription of Palestine Action. So just because a liberal international order is in crisis or always has been a facade, this does not mean the discourse of accountability, right, which is not in the monopoly of the liberal international order. This doesn't mean that the discourse of accountability does not still have material implications, both locally and globally.
Thanks so much, Jasmine. We will now invite Lena to share her comments.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Shifa and Julia, for the invitation. And I'm very happy and honored to share the stage with Jasmine, Elias, and Jenna. Apologies for not being there in the room with you. I loved the remarks that the three shared, and there's some a degree of alignment and some perhaps even repetition that will come from my remarks. But let me begin by saying that Kaepernick's response to the first mouth or the first prompt, my thoughts aligned very closely to what Jasmine was just talking about in terms of perhaps taking issue with sort of this, with the crisis itself and understanding sort of discourse and narrative around the crisis. And while I absolutely see that we are living in a moment of perhaps heightened anxiety around around sort of this narrative of the crisis, like the decline in official development assistance, for example, ODA was very much at the heart of conversations last week at the World Bank annual meetings. As we all know, also, G20 is being led by South Africa now, but the transition is going to go to the US. And so questions about US leadership of the G20 were also coming up in terms of what this means for countries in Africa, what does this mean for countries in the developing world, when leadership of something as consequential for us as the G20 is under sort of a perhaps a cynical at the very least kind of cynical approach to multilateralism. Right, so we have more than this again sort of what Jasmine mentioned, so this bias of this global right-wing politics. We see this in Europe, we see this in the US, we see this in South America and other places, right? So steeper inequalities and wealth accumulation across societies. We're seeing in when we shift the perspective and we think about what I will use, I'll use the term of global south, we can discuss how thorny and problematic this terminology is, but just for the ease of argument, from the perspective of the global south, we will not see necessarily that this is new or this is an urgent crisis. What we see is this is basically old news, right? What we see is laying bare of the power dynamics that basically permeate the international order. They are shown up in ways that are being made more visible. But that these power relations, these hierarchical power relations, this violence, is part and parcel of this order. Right? And whereas Jalen was talking about sort of perhaps this crisis, right? So it's in the kind of the superficial level, right? So perhaps the way I think about it is that it's just a cyclical sort of this narrative of a cyclical threat that somehow under some administrations or under some circumstances, world order is okay, thriving, it's doing better, and then there are others who are going back in these circles. I think these cyclical narratives are problematic. They are problematic because they assume, right, that there are a few episodes of disruption, i.e. US leading G20 or Trump election or some event is punctuating, right? So it's perforating through what is basically an otherwise stable functional order, right? It's just only these episodes of disruption, and we should go back and revert back to the sort of this order that is desirable and that works, that functions. But from the perspective, of course, from post-colonial, decolonial perspective, we all know that this isn't how the order is even perceived because it is permeated with violence. And what Jenna was speaking about earlier as well. And so it is constructed, it's one of its building blocks, one of its logics, one of its founding logics is actually violence. One of the very first move is a move of violence, is a move of othering, which I will come back to here in a minute. But I will say that this narrative framing, like, is problematic as it really takes away all of these experiences of territories, people, communities, populations that are approaching this are basically all erased and faced in favor of thinking about what does this liberal international order mean for a few core. But going back to basically thinking about sort of what perhaps what alternatives, what are we seeing, right? So yes, it's not or do away with these narratives of sort of these hierarchies and these relations of othering. And what I argue is we are seeing in this moment of transition, of alternative world order, is a world order that's coming from relations of narratives, not necessarily lived experience relations, but narratives and stories of origin that emphasize similarity and sameness, and coming from the same background of history, sharing historical struggles against colonialism, against imperialism, focusing and leaning on that shared experience to kind of launch a solidarity, a kind of an ethos, or sometimes a myth of solidarity that can carry on sort of an alternative of this liberal international order. And I will end my remarks here with just saying that I do hope that Gen Z saves us.
Thanks so much, Lena, and thanks to all of the panelists for an incredibly rich set of remarks. I'm now going to pass over to Julia, who has the tall task of trying to bring that all together. Julia will summarize and give some thoughts. And then rather than going right back to the speakers, we're actually going to open right up to Q&A. I'll tell you how that works just after Julia's comments, but take it away.
Thank you very much, Shika, and thank you to all of our panelists for their wonderful reflections. And to me, I do think that Jenna's remarks have shown us that looking at the world under the plantation lens, it becomes apparent the existence of polycentric orders, suggesting a reconsideration of the order that also includes the notion of moral orders, something that has been overlooked in the past. Ilias has, in his remarks, has actually shown us that the crisis that we're actually defining as a crisis might be seen more in depth as a multidimensional crisis of big development and small development, bringing forth alternative visions, positive even visions of order. Gen Z, we're all rooting for Gen Z on this panel, and I think beyond, China as well, including and taking into consideration also the challenges and constraints that come from these alternative visions. And Jasmine, of course, has raised very interesting questions about how to think about the efficacy and the ongoing attachments to institutions that we've long known and connected to US hegemony and US histories, while also sort of suggesting that we need to be aware of the epistemic criticism that emerges from our reconsideration of these institutions. And finally, Lena, with her remarks, has shown us that something that has been, to Shika and I, when thinking about this event, sort of the underlying theme and underlying assumption for us. So understanding the crisis today as emerging from the West, from the European histories, something that, although is not new from a Global South perspective, is something that the Global South has been, with problematic terms of the Global South, has been long aware of. But also, and I think very interestingly, is the fact that this crisis from this alternative viewpoint is not exclusively seen as something negative, but, and I really do like in her work and her remarks, the notion of solidarity that emerges from that. And on me, I do think that taking all of this together, what stands out to me more broadly is the fact that none of our panelists, none of these interventions that have actually been treating the crisis of the liberal international order has actually a real rupture. Instead, I do think that among all of these interventions, what we've seen is that there is the reconsideration of this crisis is more of an uncovering, maybe this is not, an unmasking, maybe this is not the right word, a moment when these old hierarchies, these old legacies and inequalities have become visible again, because the same legitimacy that used to hide them is now actually fading, and I'm thinking especially of Jasmine's use of the word facade. across this perspective to me as someone who in her own research has been focusing extensively on what is broadly construed as the Global South, I do see a shared effort to actually move beyond seeing the Global South as peripheral, but a space of agency and the Arendtian notion of imagination, even to an extent, a place where ideas and of world order are challenged and reconstructed. And this made me think, just I think echoing a bit what others have said, about how useful the crisis is actually as a concept. And when thinking about this event, I was thinking, I see some students from my China Global South course, and so you recognize one of the readings from the course now. So one of the articles that I generally have my students come to terms with is a student, Sanchez Ancochea's Southern Discomfort. And in that, I do think that they argue that the Global South is not a fixed space, but actually a way of seeing that reveals how power and inequality are organized in the world system. And I do think that their work still also shows the unease that we often call crisis may simply be this exposure of hierarchies that have always been there. So perhaps what the intervention together suggests is that the Global South and other alternative realities doesn't just experience the crisis, but actually help us see what lies beneath it. And in so doing, offers new ways of thinking about what world order is and perhaps has always been.
Thanks so much, Julia.